The monkeys of South America have flat noses. The monkeys of Central Africa have longer noses, but their DNA shows they're related. The question is how these cousins came to live on different continents thousands of miles apart. Until recently, most scientists believe their ancestors evolved into distinct species after the continents, once a single landmass, broke apart. But evolutionary biologist Alan Dikaitos and his colleagues say genetic tests and fossil evidence show the monkeys of the New World and other species arrived well after the continents broke up, possibly as hitchhikers on natural rafts of vegetation that floated out of African rivers and across the ocean. Alan Dikaitos and The Monkey's Voyage, next on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. We've all heard about the battles over creationism versus evolution. They still break out in the nation's culture wars from time to time. But even among biologists who believe Charles Darwin got the big picture right, there are some hot debates. Our next guest, Alan Dikaitos, is happy to be in the middle of one. How and why related species, animals and plants who can't swim or fly, turn up on continents thousands of miles apart. For example, some monkeys in South America are the kissing cousins, genetically speaking, of monkeys in Central Africa. The same goes for flightless African ostrich and a South American lookalike called the rhea. Before Darwin, most people believed these animals live where they do because that's where God put them. End of debate. But Darwin thought the explanation for many related species was more prosaic. Their common ancestors dispersed on flotsam from rivers that dumped into the oceans, or even as hitchhikers on the feet of migrating birds. Starting in the 1960s, the science of plate tectonics almost killed off Darwin's theory, known in the trade as dispersal. Like many of his cohorts, Alan Dikaitos learned that today's animals and plants began evolving into different species when the continents separated tens of millions of years ago. Now, he argues, advanced DNA testing shows that many species began to diverge genetically long after the continent split. So how did they travel thousands of miles to get to their current homes? In his new book entitled The Monkey's Voyage, Alan Dikaitos now says Darwin may actually have been right, that monkeys and other animals whose DNA history conflicts with continental drift may have dispersed naturally, possibly as unwilling passengers on natural rafts of debris that formed in the rivers of Africa and floated across the ocean to a new continent. Alan Dikaitos is an evolutionary biologist and adjunct faculty member at the University of Nevada, Reno. He has written widely cited research articles on topics ranging from biogeography, which I'm going to ask him about, to the evolution of behavior to the origins of parasites. His first book is entitled, as I say, The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. It's available from Basic Books. And Alan, it's nice to get you on the show. Alan Dikaitos, welcome to Baltimore and WIPR.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. I'm going to start our interview with where you start the book, with this anecdote about you and your then-girlfriend wrestling a very unhappy 3.5-foot snake out of its hole in the remote mountains of Baja, down in the Baja of California. First of all, was this a courting ritual of you and your girlfriend at the time?
I don't know. I think she would probably say no. She's my wife now, though, so I guess it
That's right. It all worked out. Yeah. But tell us why. I love this story at the beginning of our adventure here in this hour of the show. So tell our folks why you were interested in that particular snake. Tell us about the snake.
Well, it's a garter snake that, like you say, it lives down in the Baja California Peninsula. And I was actually interested in studying the evolution of its behavior, its foraging behavior in particular. So that's why we were down there collecting these snakes, to take them back in the lab and look at their foraging. But just finding more out about this snake one of the weird things about it is that it's found down near the tip of the Baja California Peninsula, and then the rest of the species, the other populations of the species, are found in mainland Mexico, so to speak, across the Sea of Cortez. So that led to an interesting question of why or how did that population on the peninsula get down there or get across the Sea of Cortez, or did it? You know, maybe there was some other explanation. So that's kind of what got me into thinking about these questions of biogeography, about how things have ended up where they are.
Okay, and we'll probably come back to that story about the garter snake a bit later on in our conversation. But since you've mentioned biogeography again, Alan, let's go over that. You're talking about a branch of science a lot of us have probably never heard of, although, you know, you can put together the words biology and geography. But please explain for us what that covers exactly.
Well, in a general sense, it's just the science of studying where things live, you know, where different species or higher groups live on the face of the earth, and then explaining why they're there, either in ecological terms, in terms of, you know, some things are able to live in deserts versus other things are, you know, only suited for rainforests. So that's kind of an ecological biogeographic question. Mm-hmm. But then there's also a historical question of how did particular groups get to be in particular areas, like, you know, why are certain groups in Africa or certain groups in North America? And so that's kind of the deep history aspect of biogeography, and that's really what the focus of my book is.
Mm-hmm. And it gets us back to the garter snake again, this question that you have about how do things live where they live. Here you had a garter snake, a particular type of garter snake, not the kind we'd see in our gardens here in Maryland, but it had genetic relatives across a body of water, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, and that was the conundrum, because it's not an aquatic, I mean, well, it's an aquatic snake, but it's mostly a freshwater aquatic snake.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not a thing that you find swimming out in the middle of the ocean. So the question is, you know, what explains that distribution? And actually the traditional, or, well, I don't know if traditional might be the wrong word, but the kind of recent explanation for it was that the Baja California Peninsula had actually been connected to the mainland. And that's why there were these freshwater snakes in both places. And then when the peninsula split apart, some of those snakes simply drifted with the peninsula as the Sea of Cortez was forming. So they never actually had to cross the Sea of Cortez, because they were there before it formed, and they just were carried with that drifting piece,
right,
of the continent.
Well, I think that's what a lot of us were taught in high school, about how this happened. Do you remember what you were taught in high school about how this happened, Alan?
Actually, I don't think I was taught that in high school, but in graduate school, I certainly was exposed to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And even as recently as about 15 years ago, that's kind of what I thought whenever somebody would come up with one of these weird examples, like monkeys on both sides of the Atlantic. You know, I would immediately think, oh, that's got to be because of continental drift, because of, you know, the breakup of Gondwana,
right,
or something like that.
Right. Well, that's
so
what,
that was definitely,
yeah,
in my mind.
I thought that the discussion back, I was trying to remember high school discussion of plate tectonics and Pangaea and all that, was that when the continents split up, some monkeys went over here and some monkeys went over there, and a lot of plants went over here and the other plants went over there. That was sort of the accepted idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, and also it's a very sort of elegant and attractive idea, I think. I think the word I use in the book is seductive. And I think a lot of people were seduced by it, because it's this general idea, so it applies to the whole planet, because, you know, continents have drifted all over the planet. That's, you know, it's a global phenomenon, plate tectonics, right? And then once you accept that, and, you know, that's clearly a fact, then it potentially can explain the distributions of all kinds of different land organisms or freshwater organisms. You know, why you see these weird distributions of, you know, monkeys or like those big flightless birds that you mentioned, or many different kinds of plants, insects, reptiles, whatever. So it's this very elegant general explanation. And people thought, and I have to admit that I was one of these people,
mm-hmm,
although I wasn't,
mm-hmm,
thinking about it very deeply at the time, I don't think. But, you know, I was thinking, oh, you know, that's really a cool idea. And, you know, it's so elegant, it's got to be true. And it is true to a certain extent. I don't want to say that it's not true at all. But
Well, before Darwin came along, was there any explanation other than, well, that's where God put them?
Before Darwin came along, so there were notions, and it's kind of all mixed up with religion, I think. So at some point, people started. So it's kind of interesting that at some point, people were not thinking of the Bible as being literally true. And I'm certainly not an expert about this part of history, but apparently at some point, and I think this was, you know, maybe in the 1500s or thereabouts, people started taking the Bible as literally true. And that was actually a shift in thinking. And so one of the things they started thinking about was that, oh, if the Bible's literally true, then this Noah's Ark story must be true. And that means that all of the animals, they weren't really thinking about plants so much, but all of the animals in the world were on Mount Ararat at some point when the rest of the world was flooded.
Right.
Right. And so then they started thinking, well, so now there are these animals all over the planet. So, the planet was defined in different terms then, I guess. But so the question was, how did animals get from Mount Ararat to these different places? And so then people were actually thinking about dispersal and or crossing on land bridges in this context of how did things get from Mount Ararat to all these different places as land emerged,
mm-hmm.
right? So,
and Alan,
I don't
was
know if that answers
no,
your
that
question,
helps. But. No, that helps. When we get to Charles Darwin, though, I mean, dispersal is not, that's not a is that was his theory? That word was around that was in science before Darwin.
Yeah, well, even so, like I was talking about in the context of the Noah's Ark story, people were talking about dispersal and thinking that, you know, maybe some organisms actually did disperse across water to get to certain places. Or, I mean, another thing they were thinking is that people just moved everything on boats.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, at that time they were also thinking that, you know, humans had been there from the start. So, so the idea of dispersal wasn't completely new to Darwin, but you know, he was the one who really convinced a lot of people that evolution is true, then it was suddenly dispersal within this context of evolutionary, this deep evolutionary history. So that's really the significance of Darwin.
So I see. So Darwin had credibility, and more people embraced dispersal during that time.
Yeah, actually, the story is a little complicated, because even from the start, even people who accepted evolution didn't necessarily accept Darwin's explanation for how things got to different places. So right from the start, there was this other idea that there were actually land bridges to all different parts of the world, land bridges that we now don't see because they're submerged. So people were sort of erecting these hypothetical land bridges all over the place, like between South America and Africa, or, you know, even to places like Hawaii from continents. So that was another explanation right from the start, even within this evolutionary context.
Well, Darwin actually conducted some interesting experiments in the 1850s, as you write about in your book, on dispersal. So I want to talk about that, because I think his experiments are really interesting. And we'll continue, yeah. We'll continue our conversation with you in just a minute, Alan. We're going to take our first break here. This is Midday on WYPR in Baltimore. Alan Dakatos is our guest, evolutionary biologist. His book is The Monkey's Voyage, How Things Got to Where They Are, how the improbable journeys that shape the history of life. And then we're going to talk about Darwin's experiments on dispersal, this theory of dispersal, when we get back. And then plate tectonics comes in. The story gets complicated. But anyway, more with Alan Kaderis when we get back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Continuing our conversation with Alan Dakatos, an evolutionary biologist. He's based at the University of Nevada, Reno. He says the ancestors of monkeys in the New World and many other species may have hitchhiked from Africa to the Americas on natural rafts millions of years ago, a sort of prehistoric Kon-Tiki adventure. He describes this theory, backed up by DNA and fossil evidence, in The Monkey's Voyage, I'm sorry. I want to get the subtitle correctly. How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. So, Alan, back with you again. Thank you for being with us again. I want to talk about Darwin and the actual experiments he conducted of this theory of dispersal, particularly interested in whether plants could cross oceans or seeds. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And so he conducted these experiments where he basically took seeds of a whole bunch of different kinds of plants and left them in jars of seawater for weeks and even months at a time. And then he removed them later and looked to see if they were still viable, if they still would germinate. And it turned out that a lot of seeds would survive that sort of immersion in seawater for a long time. And so the point of that, and the thing that I think is really interesting about that, is that so what he was doing was he was trying to kind of combat this idea that this is just impossible. So, you know, that was the reaction of a lot of people. And even now in this field of biogeography, that's the reaction of a certain number of people that, you know, these, you know, things can't really get across long stretches of ocean. It's just impossible. And so Darwin, by doing these experiments, was showing that, you know, even if we don't see these things happening, at least we can tell that, you know, it looks like they're possible. So that was really the key thing that came out of those experiments that he did with the plants.
Did he also demonstrate the possibility, at least, that that seeds could travel in the gizzards of seabirds?
Oh yeah, so that was another. I mean, he did a lot of the kind of interesting experiments, and one of the things he did was he put seeds insides of fish, and then he fed the fish to birds that eat fish. I'm trying to remember which. I think eagles were one of them, actually. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then he retrieved the droppings of the birds later, and again checked out the seeds to see if they would germinate. And sure enough, a lot of them would. So that was another potential mechanism that, you know, a bird could have eaten a fish that had a seed inside of it, because some fish do eat fruits, and then the bird could have flown across, you know, some stretch of ocean, and then pooped on the other side,
right?
And that would have been the way that the seed could have gotten across some expanse of ocean.
Hmm. And once the continent started to split, once all that was taking place, the shifting was taking place, we have to remember that these land masses were closer together than they are today.
Oh yeah, that's another thing, and that's something I don't know how much you want to get into the specific example of the monkeys, which I think
to the monkeys in a moment. But I'm just making the point that a bird traveling, you would think, well, can a bird travel, you know, 1,500, 2,000 miles? Actually, that's probably true. But these land masses were closer together once upon a time, millions of years ago.
Yeah. So I mean, a classic example is the Atlantic Ocean. So you know, the Atlantic Ocean started forming roughly 100 million years ago. So, and then it just got slowly, very, very slowly wider and wider. So if you go back to, say, 80 or 90 million years ago, it was actually a very narrow sea separating Africa from South America. So it would have been much easier for land organisms to get across that way back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's true of a whole, you know, there's many other circumstances just like that involving other land masses.
I know one other thing about the travel of birds. Freshwater snails could have made the crossing clinging to the feet of ducks, the webbed feet of ducks or other birds with webbed feet.
Yeah, so that was another weird little experiment that Darwin did. I think Darwin really liked to do these weird little experiments. And this one, he took some ducks' feet. So he just the feet, not the whole duck. So he took the feet and stuck them in a tank that had freshwater snails in it, and he wanted to see whether the snails would actually end up on the duck's feet, and you know, sure enough, they did. And so that was kind of another little experiment to show that, well, here's another possible mechanism of how something could get across an ocean. You know, obviously, freshwater snails can't fly, but if they're attached to a bird's feet, then they you know, can get across.
So, Alan. Alan, getting back to that word dispersal again and this idea about how species got to where they are, was that pretty much accepted from Darwin's time forward until we get to Alfred Wegener?
No, so it's kind of interesting that, you know, so Darwin was a big believer in this idea of dispersal, and that it explained, for instance, the, you know, like the flora and fauna of the Hawaiian Islands or the Galapagos and a lot of other situations like that. But then there was this whole other school of thought called the land, you know, the Landbridge school, which was, and these people were, like I said, they were thinking that, oh, you know, these things can't really get across oceans like that, or it's incredibly difficult. So to explain why there are thing all these different plants and animals on islands like Hawaii or the Galapagos, we have to assume that there were land bridges. And so that was a really actually a significant, there were a significant number of people thinking that, biologists thinking that, and especially around the turn of the century. You know, if you look in books then, there's all these different hypothetical land bridges going all over the place. And that was an alternative to this idea of that things were dispersing across oceans.
I mentioned the name Alfred Wegener. Please talk about him and the role he plays in all of these theories. And later on, we get to the 1960s, I think, for him.
Yeah, well, Wegener, so he's basically the father of continental drift. So around 1910, he came up with this idea. And actually, the idea of continental drift goes back much farther than that. I think even in the 1500s, people were, you know, somebody noticed the fit between South America and Africa, that it looks like they're you know, pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that had fit together. And so even way back then, you know, people, or at least a few people, were thinking that they had, those continents had been together at one point and had drifted apart. But Wegener was the one who really, he put together all kinds of evidence for this. And he wrote a pretty detailed book about it that actually went through several different revisions, and it got more and more detailed with each revision. And so that was around, well, when he started thinking about this was around 1910, and I think it was in about 1915 when he actually published his big book about it. But the result of that was certainly not that scientists in general were converted to this idea of continental drift. For the most part, that idea was not accepted, and most people thought, you know, most geologists thought that Wegener was just wrong and that, you know, he was kind of crazy in a way. Although there's some difference. Like in the U.S., almost everybody thought that. In Europe, his idea was a little bit more accepted, but still, it was certainly not accepted in general. So the idea of continental drift wasn't validated until much later, until the 60s, basically, when a lot of new information started coming out about, you know, the evidence for seafloor spreading, basically.
Right. The new, pretty new science of plate tectonics.
Right, right.
So now it's important that I think we talk about species divergence, because timing is everything in all of this, right? Which came first, Alan? So let's talk a little bit about your research and what you found when we talk about species divergence and when things happened. Because if you go with the drift theory, all these things happen pretty much because of drift. But you've come up with different theories and different evidence that supports Darwin. So I want you to take a minute here for our listeners and explain that.
Yeah, well, I can use the garter snake example
to
kind of illustrate
that.
Mm-hmm. And just to back up, though, I think this is really the critical thing that has sort of changed people's minds about how common these ocean crossings have been. Okay, it's really the DNA evidence of the past, say, 15 or 20 years that's really changed the way biologists think about this.
Okay.
And so to get back to the garter snakes, so there was this population of garter snakes on the Baja California Peninsula, and then the other populations of the same species were across the Sea of Cortez on the sort of mainland Mexico, so to speak. But when we looked at the DNA of those peninsular garter snakes, it's essentially identical to the ones on the mainland, or very nearly identical. And so what that indicates is that the peninsular snakes haven't been separated from the mainland snakes for very long. In fact, probably only on the order of a few hundred thousand years. And if you think about the sort of plate tectonic explanation that they're there because they were on the peninsula when it was part of the mainland,
mm-hmm.
The peninsula separated from the mainland on the order of like 4 to 8 million years ago. Okay, so these snakes are far too similar genetically to their relatives on the mainland for that to make sense, right? So if it was the case that they split apart from their mainland relatives because of the splitting of the peninsula from the mainland, then they should be pretty genetically different from the ones on the mainland because they split that, you know, that long ago, millions of years ago. So what the genetic evidence shows is that that couldn't possibly be right because these peninsular snakes are just way too similar to the mainland ones. And so what it implies is that the peninsular ones must have gotten there by crossing the Sea of Cortez. So that's just kind of a very small example, but the same sort of reasoning applies to all kinds of different cases. You know, so like another case would be there are rodents in Africa that are related to rodents in South America, like guinea pigs and capybaras. And if you look at the DNA of those two groups, the African ones and the South American ones, it looks like those groups separated, you know, on the order of maybe 50 million years ago. And by then, there was a wide Atlantic separating South America from Africa. So it looks like those rodents must have crossed the ocean to get to South America.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same kind of reasoning with the garter snakes, just kind of
this is really interesting.
On a larger scale.
By the way, Sea of Cortez, I think you said about 120 miles.
Yeah, right? It's about that.
That crossing to Baja would have been 120 miles. And getting back to what I said earlier, noting in the continental drift theory, combined with your theories and Darwin's, these animals wouldn't have had to have floated very far at once upon a time, going back millions of years, because these land masses were closer together.
Yeah, well, so thinking about that rodent case again, the rodents that are in South America and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that they crossed the ocean about 50 million years ago. Well, at that time, the Atlantic Ocean was less than half as wide as it is now. So it would have been quite a bit easier for them to get across than it is now. But it's still a pretty significant journey. I mean, it would have been hundreds of miles, presumably on some kind of natural raft. So it's still a pretty rare and unusual event, but not as bizarre as it would be now.
This is really interesting. Now, on the species divergence, some folks listening in our audience may wonder, well, how does he know that? How does he know that they're too kindred to have separated that a long time ago? I mean, I said timing is everything in this. How do you know? Is it through genetic sequencing? I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, it sort of all rests on this idea of the molecular clock, which is this idea that kind of in a simplistic sense, that if you look at the genetic differences between two species or two higher groups, that the amount of difference is related to how long they've been separated from each other. So it's definitely not a perfect clock, and then the clock sort of runs at a different rate in different groups, okay? So there's all kinds of methods for trying to correct for that. But again, sort of in a general sense, there's a relationship between how different two groups are genetically and how long they've been separated in evolutionary terms.
Okay.
So that's kind of what this whole thing rests on, this idea of the molecular clock.
Is there some dispute about that, the accuracy, the precision of this molecular clock?
Yeah, so there's actually huge dispute over this.
Oh.
And so that's one reason why there's sort of a significant minority of biologists who really don't believe this and are really tied to still explaining all these examples through continental drift or other processes that fragment land masses. So it doesn't necessarily have to be continental drift. It could be something like sea level rise that separates two land masses. But anyway, these people are thinking that, you know, this molecular clock stuff is just so, I mean, you know, it relies on too many assumptions. And so we just can't believe this at all. So let's go back, you know, what we really should believe is, you know, these fragmentation explanations like continental drift. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of dispute about that. And I guess, I mean, in a way, I'd sort of refer people to the book to really get into the details of this.
Oh, there's plenty of them in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alan, yeah, we need to take another break, and when we get back,
okay,
we'll talk about the monkeys, the monkeys' passage. The Monkey's Voyage is the name of Alan Decato's book. Excuse me, Alan. The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. A little bit more with Alan when we get back. If you have questions, feel free to call Midday 410-662-8780, 866-661-9309. The Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. And we'll talk about the monkey rafts when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here in conversation with Alan Dekatos, an evolutionary biologist who says the ancestors of monkeys in the New World and many other species of animals and plants may have hitchhiked from Africa to the Americas on natural rafts millions of years ago, a theory that's gained a lot of traction in recent years, but is still a hot topic in the scientific community. We'll talk about that in a moment. Alan describes his theory and the DNA and fossil evidence behind it in this book, The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life from Basic Books. So, Alan, I mean, do you get jokes about monkey rafts from colleagues, friends, people who disagree or agree with you?
Oh, yeah, sure. And especially with the monkey example, monkeys crossing the Atlantic, I think a lot of people are, you know, especially if you haven't really looked into the evidence, you know, the initial reaction is that couldn't possibly happen, monkeys crossing the Atlantic.
Well, from my reading of all this, the DNA makes all the difference, doesn't it? The technology that allows you to study the DNA.
Yeah, and I should actually go back to that, the idea of the molecular clock, just for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this big dispute about the kind of accuracy of the molecular clock. But a lot of these analyses, like including the one with the monkeys, so looking at monkeys in South America versus African monkeys, these analyses have been done with a huge amount of data and with also calibrating the clock with fossils. So that's actually a key part of it. It's not just based all on, I mean, it has to be based in some sense on fossils also. So the fossils kind of tell you, at least in a rough sense, how rapidly the clock is going, or, you know, the rate of the molecular clock. And for some of these examples, people have done the analyses in a bunch of different ways, and sort of all the different plausible ways you could do this still give you this answer that, in that case, for instance, monkeys must have crossed the Atlantic. So I didn't want to make it sound like, you know, this is, you know, very, very up in the air, because I think that it's becoming pretty solid in a lot of cases that there must have been these ocean crossings.
And when did those crossings occur, based on the best DNA evidence that you have, when monkeys crossed the Atlantic?
Well, so for the monkeys, it looks like, so the fossils of monkeys first show up, or the first ones we know about, are about 26 million years ago. So we know that monkeys were there by then. And then the molecular clock analyses, I'm not going to get into the details of this, but it indicates that it couldn't have happened more than about 50 million years ago. And it was probably quite a bit after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, probably somewhere on the order of 30 to 40 million years ago is when it happened.
Okay. And where was Pangaea at that point in terms of the continents?
Well, so, So Pangaea had already separated into the two big land masses of Laurasia and Gondwana. And then by then, Gondwana was also pretty much broken up. So, by, say, 40 million years ago, the continents were at least roughly in the configuration they're in today. But there were some significant differences, like the Atlantic was only about half as wide as it is now.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So now I just want you to sort of envision what might have happened, or describe your vision of what might have happened. And I don't mean to, I'm not making light of this at all. I think this theory is fascinating. I think this research is fascinating. But I do wonder, you know, about this idea of drifting, of animals drifting on vegetation, flowing out of rivers across this passage, even if it was only a matter of hundreds of miles and not thousands of miles.
But right.
Give me your describe that vision that you have of it, Alan.
Yeah. So the vision for the monkeys is that, I mean, you know, obviously we don't know how this happened. Nobody was there to observe it. But for the monkeys, obviously you can't talk about, you know, monkeys just floating in the ocean. They're not going to float 900. You know, a monkey's not going to float 900 miles in the ocean and survive. and you know, it's not going to be stuck to a duck's feet or anything like that. So really just about the only plausible explanation is that they were on some kind of a natural raft. And rafts like that can and do form in big rivers like the Congo, where basically, especially during storms, big chunks of the bank can get undercut and sort of fall into the river. So these are big chunks of earth and vegetation, you know, that might actually have like full-grown trees on them and things like that. So we're talking about a pretty big chunk here. And so almost any kind of an organism, at least potentially, could be floating on one of those rafts with it. And then it could float down to the ocean. And it turns out that in the case of the Atlantic, there are currents that would plausibly push a raft like that all the way across the ocean in a matter of weeks. So it's still going to be a difficult thing because, you know, if there's not enough food or water, you know, if it doesn't rain and if there's not enough food on that raft, then, you know, maybe the monkeys are going to die of, you know, maybe they're going to die of thirst or starvation before they get across. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously something that's really improbable and rare, but it does seem like it's at least possible. And apparently it did happen according to the DNA and fossil evidence.
Well, we keep coming back to the DNA, and because of the DNA, it seems to me you need to have a theory like this.
Yeah, so that's exactly right, and that's kind of what it's all coming back to is that, again, in a general sense, we hardly ever, in fact, almost never know exactly how these things happened. So in a book, I talk about so-called how possibly stories because, you know, for a lot of these cases, we really don't know, but we can at least come up with, like Darwin did with the seeds and the, you know, the snails on the duck's feet,
mm-hmm.
they're kind of stories of how these things could possibly have happened. And if those stories are at least reasonable, then that at least gives you some more confidence that, you know, that this thing really did happen. But it's really the DNA evidence in particular that's pointing to that and sort of forcing us to look more deeply at how it could possibly have happened.
So a big, again, I emphasize the word natural raft of vegetation with trees growing out of it, something that's been that existed for a while, floats across the ocean. The raft kind of lands. Monkeys get off. They're happy to get on land and look for bananas or whatever they can find.
Yeah,
I don't know, but they're in South America at this point.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And then the rest is evolutionary history, right? They become other kinds of monkeys over millions of years, right?
Yeah. And actually, one thing I should mention is, you know, just getting across isn't the end of the story. Because if you imagine some small group of monkeys gets over to South America, I mean, if you saw that happen and you were going to bet, you know, what's going to be the fate of that group, probably you would bet they're just going to go extinct. I mean, it's a tiny group. They'll probably just by chance, they're going to blink out. I mean, that's probably what happens to most small groups that do some, you know, make some giant voyage like that.
It only takes two, baby.
So
it only takes two.
Yeah, or even one. It could take could be a pregnant female.
That's
right?
So funny. So, I mean, I was going to ask you that. Did you need to have a mass of monkeys in order to pull this off? Did you need to have like a whole raft full of monkeys? Did you need to have like hundreds of monkeys, or could two monkeys have pulled it off?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, at least theoretically, even just a single pregnant female could have pulled it off.
Yeah.
Although that brings up another question that some people have brought to me sort of after reading the book, which is, you know, if the group is really small, isn't it just going to kind of collapse genetically because, you know, you're going to have close relatives breeding with each other, and then there's also just not going to be enough genetic diversity in that group? And that's an interesting question, and the thing I point to for that is that there are actually a lot of cases of introduced species, things that humans have brought, you know, across oceans,
mm-hmm.
in very small groups, just a handful of organisms, and in many cases, those groups have, you know, exploded into huge populations, sometimes of millions of individuals. So it looks like, again, that's something that can happen, even though, I mean, these negative genetic effects of starting with a very small group are real, but I don't think they preclude these things happening, of very small groups, you know, turning into big ones.
I get you. And could you talk about flightless birds, too, in this context in terms of the DNA and the passage. This also happened with some birds?
Yeah, well, so birds are actually a really interesting sort of set of cases because, you know, they're like the ones you mentioned, the ostriches. And their relatives on these different southern continents. So it's starting to look like, you know, at least some of those lineages must have crossed oceans to get where they are today. And it's kind of a complicated story, but I don't know if I would really bet on that at this point because the DNA evidence it's not as strong as it is in some cases. Birds definitely do get across oceans. I mean, if you just look at Hawaii has a bunch of native bird lineages, and they, you know, that got there naturally. And the surprising thing about land birds, though, actually, is that they probably don't get across oceans, or at least get across and establish themselves, maybe as much as you would think. So that's kind of a case that, in some ways, goes the other way. That, you know, you'd think maybe birds would just be crossing oceans willy nilly and, you know, everything would be all mixed up, but that's not really what you see with birds. I mean, you do see examples where they must have crossed oceans, but it's not, you know, it's not completely rampant like you might expect.
Hmm. And plant life, I would think, given the theory about the floating rafts, these natural rafts that might occur, that might have come out of African rivers, I would think this would be a pretty common thing. And given also Darwin's experiments proving that the seeds could survive passage through salt water.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So plants, unlike birds, for plants, it really does look like these ocean crossings have been incredibly frequent. You know, so there literally must have been thousands upon thousands of these cases where plants have gotten across some significant stretch of ocean and established themselves on the other side. You know, there's just, I mean, sort of endless examples like that. And I think the key, it kind of does go back to Darwin, because seeds are basically these little propagules that are kind of in suspended animation, you know. So they're just in many cases just ideally suited for long distance travel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what I think. That's one of the key things that separates plants from at least most kinds of animals.
Alan Dakedos, our guest in this hour of midday, his book, The Monkey's Voyage. A question for you from Melissa, one of our listeners in Baltimore. Melissa, welcome to Midday, and you're on with our guests.
Oh, hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question, Alan, is the sort of fundamental argument that you're making about the change in DNA being linked to an amount of time.
Right.
So it sounds like if we had these two monkey groups, let's say 100 million years ago, and they separated through a continental drift process, they would, by virtue of the amount of time they had been apart, their DNA would have changed considerably more.
Right.
Am I understanding
exactly
that assumption correctly?
Yeah. Right.
So, but isn't the amount of DNA change based on environment and adaptation to the environment leading to survival?
Well, yeah, it is. So that's certainly one of the complications, is that, you know, natural selection.
Right, so
selection.
I'm seeing the environment in South America as being not that dissimilar from the environment in Africa. So I'm sort of imagining if you were to control this experiment and you were to take monkeys a million years ago and plop them in very similar environments with very similar challenges to survival, and then plop them in with very different environments, then the DNA might change at a different rate based on the difference in the environments that they're living in.
Right. Yeah, so that's actually, you know, one of the serious complications with this molecular clock idea is that the rate of change is dependent on all kinds of things, like the environment. It's also dependent on things like the size of the animal and, you know, like the generation time of the animal or plant. And really what it gets back to, I mean, it's that there's this huge body of data now, this DNA data. And it can be analyzed in a lot of different ways. And to get back to your specifically the question about selection in different environments, like adaptation to different environments, you can actually do these analyses looking at parts of the DNA that probably aren't very affected by that. So, like, there are certain, you know, I don't know if I want to get into the the gory details of this, but there are certain changes in the DNA that are probably not related to selection. They're things that just happen, right? And there's actually a lot of changes like that. And so you can do the analysis, you know, only looking at those changes. But and so that's one way around it. But it's also just from looking at a lot of these different cases that are, like I said, calibrated by fossil data. So you have so you can actually get some kind of independent evidence of how fast the clock is running. And when you look at all of that, it's still like for the monkey case, it still tells you, you know, these things could not have separated 100 million years ago.
Right,
it's just not plausible when you look at sort of all the evidence.
But, Alan,
but it's a good question, definitely.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. I want to say you're not saying that all the related species on distant continents got there this way or by water. Actually, the continental drift theory is still valid, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And land bridge, what about, and land bridge theory is still valid?
Yeah, land bridges, I mean, I think it's a case of just in both cases, like the land bridge school where people were imagining land bridges, even to places like Hawaii and Samoa that, you know, there's really no geological evidence for, you know, they just got kind of carried away with that. And I think the same thing is true with continental drift. I mean, clearly continental drift is a fact. And clearly, when drift happened, there were organisms on those different land masses that got separated. And even and when you look today, you can find, you know, some what look like pretty good examples of that. So it's not a question of, you know, is it only dispersal versus only continental drift? It's definitely a combination. And what I'm arguing in the book is that the dispersal aspect had been underestimated.
Yeah.
And the DNA evidence is showing that you know, these crossings of oceans are far more common than we had thought.
I think Charles Darwin would be very pleased with you. Wouldn't you like to have supper with him?
Yeah, I actually mentioned that a couple times in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, and I was thinking that as I was writing it. You know,
yeah, I know.
It would be great if Darwin could have seen this.
Yeah, he's vindicated, and so is Alfred Wegener. They're vindicated too. So there's a little bit of that in all of this, and
right.
I like it. I think you would have liked to have gone to dinner with Charles Darwin and hand him a copy of your book, and he would have been very pleased with this.
Yeah, he would. He might have needed some basics about genetics,
about DNA,
and that before he could have understood everything. But
you would have had to update him a little bit on that,
right,
during cocktail hour, and then sit down and have dinner and talk about the passage of the monkeys.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Congratulations on your book, Alan. And boy, this is real interesting. And I guess it's still provoking some controversy, but that's what science is all about. Alan, it's been great to have you on the show. Alan Dekatos, who's at the university, he teaches at the University of Nevada, Reno. And by the way, how is that garter snake? Is the garter snake still around? The one from Baja?
Oh, you mean the one we caught?
Yeah.
I don't know if I. Unfortunately, that snake is now a museum specimen.
Oh, okay.
But
Alan, nice having you on the show. Congratulations again on the book. The book is the Monkey's Voyage: How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. It's published by Basic Books. And Alan, happy trails.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for
nice
having me.
Nice talking to you. And thank you everybody for tuning in to our midday for today for our. Director today, Matt Tacca. I wish you a nice afternoon. We'll see you again soon. See you tomorrow, I hope.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.